slow fade. That's what's been happening throughout Judges. And we're going to see where it got the people for the decisions that they made, the choices that they made. And we're going to see that there was a price to be paid as we get to Judges chapter 19. Today's text, it reads like an X-rated Hollywood script. This is the type of thing that if it's playing in the room, you know, Karen comes in and says, "Turn that thing off." No, that's what this script is here. It's almost going to be embarrassing to read the text. It's the type of thing that, you know, for the most part, God doesn't even want us to be discussing some of these things. But unfortunately, we've been exposed to so much depravity in our culture. It's difficult to shock us anymore. We're people that's almost beyond being shocked. That's a sad reality for the people of God. In fact, we have far too much in common today with the children of Israel back in the days here when there was no king, as it sets the time frame here. That explains, I think, why God goes to such great lengths in this perplexing chapter. Why is it even in here? How, you know, it's just such a dark and dreary chapter. And yet I think God is putting it in here to say he needs it for shock value, to try to shock his people out of their moral lethargy. Somebody needs to take a stand for righteousness. Somebody needs to speak up and say that they actually hate evil, that they're not just going to be assimilated into a culture of darkness and of depravity. They're not just going to slowly boil like the frog. That they're going to speak up. Our society has fallen. It's fallen to the depths of moral depravity that we don't even realize because we've become callous to it and we're beyond that shocking point. But our society has fallen to such an extent we can't get up. You know that saying? We've fallen and we can't get up. Chapters 17 to 18 that we looked at earlier in Judges, they spoke of the religious decline in the nation. The people tried to combine the worship of God in some form with some idolatrous practices from the people among whom they were neighbors. Now, they had been commanded by God to conquer these people, to cast out, to drive out their enemies. But because they let them coexist with them, they reaped the results of being assimilated again into their culture. And they ended up adopting, as we saw, a man-made religious system, a counterfeit religious system, where they set up their own local shrines as opposed to worshiping God at Shiloh. They set up and appointed and ordained their own priests just by virtue of convenience and expediency so that they would have something that they were comfortable with and that they could control. But inevitably, religious decline is linked to moral decline. And so we see chapters 17 to 18, the religious decline, and now that's linked in chapters 19 to 21 to this moral decline and moral depravity that we're going to see. I have an illustration that I'm going to take in some depth here from Gary Inrig that I think sets the stage for this chapter. He says, speaks of an incident back in April 3rd, 1977. So that goes back a ways. I really don't remember the incident. Maybe you will. It was in a place called Tenerife. T-E-N-E-R-I-F-E. Tenerife? I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. It says, most of us probably weren't very sure of the location even of the Canary Islands. But on that day, April 3rd, 1977, at a little airport, two large 747 planes collided on the runway. The accident left 575 people dead. So this is a major catastrophe. There were some questions about that tragedy which will never be answered, but the chief facts are fairly clear as to what went wrong. It was a foggy day. The two pilots could not see each other, but for some inexplicable reason, the Dutch pilot began his takeoff without clearance from the control tower. Obviously, he thought he was doing the right thing, just like we read in Judges. Every man does what is right in his own eyes. He thought he was doing the right thing, but clearly he was not. The other plane was in the way. He was unable to avoid it, and as a result, hundreds of people were killed. Every pilot is taught one very basic lesson at the beginning of his training. In an air traffic control zone, you do not do what is best in your own eyes. You don't make up the rules. You do what the control tower tells you to do. It's always true. It's especially true if the visibility is bad and you don't even have perspective. The reason is very simple. The controller knows things that you do not know. He has a perspective that is better. He has more information. He is there to guide you safely to your destination. To act on your own creates disasters. This is an obvious principle of aviation, but it's also an important principle of life. We live at a time when a thick moral fog has settled upon our society. The old moral landmarks have been obliterated. No one seems to know the difference even between right and wrong. Ethically and morally, the visibility is nil. People are groping for anything that will help them find their directions. It's very tempting in times like this to fly by the seat of your pants, to just make it up, to live by whatever seems right in your own eyes. But Scripture clearly says God has given us direction. We have the control tower from the Lord Jesus Christ to guide us and to direct us. But here we're going to see what happens when we're just take things on our own and when we just live according to what seems right in our own eyes. So let's look here in this sad chapter in Israel's history, Judges chapter 19. In fact, it's so sad that other prophets later on, they point to this instance in the city of Gibeah and how the men of Gibeah acted. And they point to this as the depths of moral depravity in the nation. If they want to contrast something and say, boy, do you remember when things really went bad and how bad you can get? They point back to just as if you would point to Sodom and Gomorrah back in Genesis chapter 19. Let's read the first 9 verses here of Judges 19, and we'll take it in the sections that I've outlined in the back of the bulletin. Now it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel that there was a certain Levite. And this is a different Levite than the one that we met earlier. There's a certain Levite staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judah. But his concubine played the harlot against him, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah. She was there for a period of 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her in order to bring her back, taking with him his servant and a pair of donkeys. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. His father-in-law, the girl's father, detained him, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. Now on the 4th day, they got up early in the morning, and he prepared to go. And the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Sustain yourself with a piece of bread, and afterward you may go." So both of them sat down and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, "Please, be willing to spend the night. Let your heart be merry." Then the man arose to go, but his father-in-law urged him so that he spent the night there again. On the 5th day, he arose to go early in the morning, and the girl's father said, "Please sustain yourself, wait until afternoon." So both of them ate. When the man arose to go, along with his concubine and servant, his father-in-law, the girl's father said to him, "Behold, now the day's drawn to a close. Please spend the night. Lo, the day's coming to an end. Spend the night here, that your heart may be merry. Then tomorrow you may rise early for your journey, so that you may go home." We're going to see that God has given us 4 pictures, 4 shockwaves to wake people up from their moral lethargy. We have to ask ourselves, what does it take to shock people anymore? What does it take to shock the people of God so that they get the message of how bad things are? Well, this first shockwave speaks of this liaison that this Levite has. Levite, should be a spiritual leader. Okay? He's not from one of the 12 tribes. He's set apart to be a Levite. And here he's in this liaison, this shocking liaison with a concubine. And you wonder how, it's just presented as matter of fact. It's not even presented by the narrator as anything that has seriously gone wrong. But it's presented because it should shock us that these things are just out here. That here we have this Levite in this relationship to show us that he's been living, this Levite's been living a life of compromise, as has his concubine. And it's this compromise in these little areas. We think, well, what could it matter how this one family lives? Well, what could matter is that eventually, from the ramifications of this incident that we're going to be looking at in chapter 19, that just, it only affects this one family. No, it affects the whole nation, because you're almost going to end up wiping out the whole tribe of Benjamin as we go into the next couple chapters. as a result of what happens here, you're going to see that Benjamin's going to be reduced to only 600 men. They're not even going to have any women left for which the men can choose marriage partners. They're going to be almost devastated to the point that a whole tribe is wiped out, and the whole internal structure of the unity of the people of Israel is at stake. All of that hinges on these decisions that are being made in relationships and life choices, and how this Levite is carrying out the mission that God has in terms of being set aside to educate people about the law of God, set apart to be a religious example for the people. He's not performing any of those functions. And it's having an impact that's this slow fade that is going to compromise the entire nation. So, as we see the beginning of this this first shockwave here, we see this seesawing relationship. It's sort of an up and down roller coaster where they're together and then they're separated and they try and get back together, and we have this whole seesawing up and down roller coaster kind of relationship. It starts with him, the record of him hooking up with this concubine. It says it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel. It's just dating the period that this isn't being presented chronologically. It's not that these last three chapters, that these events happened at the end after all the judges, because they didn't. They happened. This event apparently happened maybe early on in the period of judges, but it's presented thematically here in how the author wants to present the story. But Israel, because they had refused to acknowledge the theocratic rule of God, as God being the one who would be able to give them those moral absolutes and provide the direction of how you follow a path of righteousness, they rejected God's rule. And so the author is saying it's a time when there was no king. Would there be a righteous king that would come and like David, would institute righteousness in the land? But now the people have no moral compass. They're just adrift. Everybody doing their own thing. And that's the time period that these events occur. So this Levite man who's sort of wandering around here, you wonder why he's not tied down to some Levitical city. Why is he even from some remote part of the hill country of Ephraim? That doesn't sound like a place where this Levite should be, you know, having his tent pitched. It sounds like he's just sort of a wanderer and sort of disconnected from what God's purpose is for his life. You don't get any sense of mission as you go through this story. He's got time to just sit around and make himself merry at his father-in-law's house. And there's no sense of being driven to say, hey, in the midst of this moral decay in the land, there's something I'd better be doing to try and right the ship, to try and bring God's perspective to bear in the situation. There's none of that in the perspective of this man. He just seems to have his own thing going in this remote place that he lives off in Ephraim. And now he had had this relationship with this concubine. And even to have a relationship with a concubine, that's sort of it's a hard thing for us to grapple with, because it's so weird. It's so strange. I mean, she's referred to later on as sort of a wife, but she's not a wife with all the privileges of inheritance and all the privileges of status that a wife would have. And a wife didn't have necessarily all the privileges that wives have today in their society. But a concubine was definitely a lower level status. It's almost like you have this class order where you have a wife, you have a concubine, and then you have a slave kind of relationship. It's almost sort of in that mix. This concubine, men could be taking concubines. Maybe the wife that he had wasn't able to bear children, so maybe they took a concubine for the purpose of raising up a seed, or maybe it was for some other economic purpose, or just for the lust of the flesh. And he's adding, you know, women into his harem. It's just a weird thing for us to even grapple with the concept that he has this type of relationship. But these are little compromises. These are big compromises that lead down the road to tragedy in his life. So we see that that his concubine engages now in harlotry that creates this separation. So in verse 2, we see that she's probably fearful after you know, being unfaithful in this semi-relationship type of thing. Yet she's unfaithful even in that, and she goes and has relations, I guess, with somebody else, and now she's probably fearful to come back to her husband, and so she flees back to her father's house, and she's back there now for a long period. I mean, 4 months is a long time of of separation, it appears that the husband is expecting, well, maybe she's going to come to her senses and maybe she's going to come back. And so he seems to be waiting. And when he doesn't see any response on her part, he now takes the initiative and he now wants to go and to initiate some type of reconciliation. So he's seeking reconciliation, and he goes, it says in verse, they rose and went after him to speak tenderly. I like that phrase, speak tenderly. You know, this man, he's just a model of, we're going to see a model of compassion and a model of sensitivity and understanding and just what you would want in a husband in a relationship. No, not quite. So I think this speaking tenderly was maybe somewhat of an act. That doesn't seem to be at the core of his attributes, of what his strengths are. But he's going after her, and he's got his servant. He's got the expectation he's going to bring her home because he brings a donkey for her to ride along as well. And it's interesting to me that when he comes to back to her house and meets them, everybody's all happy and excited. I mean, where is there? There's no sense of any consequences for sin or any dealing with things that might have been wrong on his part. I mean, she might have been driven into this, you know, unfaithful relationship by things on his part in terms of how he mistreated her. I mean, he's no paragon of virtue throughout this whole incident as we get deeper into it. But, you know, you wonder, why, how could he come back and how could there be all of this rejoicing, you know? It's almost as if the woman's father had never met him before. It's like it's almost as if he's meeting this Levite for the first time, and he's so pleased to meet him, and he brings him into his home, and now he wants to, he's happy at the prospect that there could be this reunion, because I'm sure it's a shameful thing on the part of his family, that now he's stuck with his, you know, his daughter has come back to him, and she's been in these different relationships with men, and it's a shameful thing, and it's just a mess. His family situation is a mess. So I think he sees an opportunity here to get out from under that a little bit, to patch things up, and to try to at least create some semblance of order in their two homes. And so he views it as a very positive thing. Now, it's interesting that Leviticus, we won't turn there, but Leviticus 21, verse 14, specifically says with respect to a priest, and now all Levites were not priests, but priests would be a subset of Levites, but instructions regarding priests were that a widow or a divorced woman or one who is profaned by harlotry, the priest may not take one like that. Rather, he is to marry a virgin of his own people. And so you have some complexities here. Of course, this was someone that he had been in a relationship with initially, before the harlotry. And then the harlotry ensues, and then he's taking her back. But it's just, when you get into these types of things, it's never pretty. It's never an easy thing to sort out, because you muddy the waters from God's standards of how you should conduct yourselves. And so, but at least what I read from this account is, everybody seems to be taking the sin aspects very casually. In other words, sexual misdeeds and transgressions are just sort of wiped away and they're not dealt with, and you don't see anybody really coming to a place of repentance where they really acknowledge what their behavior has been. And so we see now he's sort of sidetracked. There's this excessive partying that takes place, and you have this tension between the man wants to get back on his journey. I came here to pick up my concubine and to take her back home. Yes, it was nice to experience the hospitality of the father-in-law, but there's this struggle between I really want to get going, and yet he keeps encouraging me to stay and party on, and everybody's making merry, and I'm sure there's a lot of drinking and feasting and good times are going on. It's interesting, the concubine's in the background of that. It's like the two men get together and have this, you know, man's day where they're enjoying all this. I don't know if the concubine is just serving up the food or whatever, but she's very much in a lower class of status throughout this time here. But one thing that's introduced here is the whole concept of hospitality in the Oriental mindset, and that's something that we maybe have difficulty identifying with as well, is they really have a sense that if you come under my roof, I'm taking you in, and I'm the one that's going to provide, you know, in a sumptuous way for you to enjoy yourself. I'm taking that upon myself to show you a good time, to take care of your needs, to provide for you in terms of hospitality. They had a very deep-rooted sense of fellow countrymen and how we take care of one another. Now here, it goes beyond fellow countrymen. Now you're family. He's incorporating this person into his family, and so it's a great opportunity for this father-in-law to show the graciousness and the generosity of his hospitality, which is now going to stand in contrast, as we read through the rest of the chapter, to those who are unwilling to show hospitality to the Levite in this man. So he's delayed for 3 days, and then looks like he's going to get going. But then on the fourth day, he's delayed again. And then it gets to the fifth day, and we see the providential timing that's going to be involved in this whole account. I mean, it's going to be significant that he doesn't get away until the middle of the afternoon. I mean, if he had left at the crack of dawn, he'd be able to go back on his way and be able to continue on home. But because of the timing of things and how things get delayed and he gets sidetracked, and because he can't just have that resolve and just be on his mission, that timing is going to put him in a precarious situation. Back in those days, you don't want to certainly be traveling at night. It's not like you can turn the headlights on and you've got the street lights and you can, you know. You better, before it gets too much towards dusk, you better have established where you're lodging for the night, and that better be someplace that's safe and secure, because there's a lot of dangers along the way when you're not protected and you're not in an environment of trust and a refuge that you know what it's all about. So we see this first shockwave. It's just, to me, it's shocking to see this liaison of a Levite with a concubine here. And again, it's just paving the way for further compromise that's going to lead down this path of moral decay. But now we're going to read this longer account, verses 10 to 21, where we're going to see this shocking lack of hospitality. And we're going to see just, you know, society just degenerating as we go on here. So verses 10 to 21, try and stick with me here. But the man was not willing to spend the night, so he arose and departed. So he finally gets going. He came to a place opposite Jebus, that is, it later came to be called Jerusalem, we would know it by, but it's inhabited by the Jebusites. And there were with him a pair of saddle donkeys. His concubine also was with him. I mean, it's interesting that the donkeys almost get played before the concubine in terms of how he listens with them. I mean, it's very shocking, the low status in which this concubine finds herself. When they were near Jebus, the day was almost gone, and the servant said to his master, "Well, please come, let us turn aside into the city of the Jebusites. Let's spend the night in it." So that's the suggestion that the servant has. It turns out the servant had more wisdom than the master in this case. However, his master said to him, "We're not going to turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not of the sons of Israel." Oh, what a distinction. We should expect great treatment by the sons of Israel compared to the city of foreigners. "We'll go as far as Gibeah." So he said to his servant, "Come, let us approach one of these places. We'll spend the night in Gibeah, or maybe go a little bit further to Ramah." So we have enough light, apparently, to make it to Gibeah or to Ramah, which are in the tribe of Benjamin. So they passed along. They went their way. The sun set on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin. So they weren't going to make it to Ramah. Now they have no choice. So they turned aside there in order to enter and lodge in Gibeah. When they entered, they sat down in the open square of the city. And here's the significant phrase, "For no one took them into the house to spend the night." So we're going to see a significant lack of hospitality on the part of these men of Gibeah. "Then behold, an old man was coming out of the field from his work at evening. Now the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was staying in Gibeah, but the men of the place were Benjaminites. He lifted up his eyes, and he saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, 'Where are you going? Where do you come from?' And he said to him, 'Well, we're passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim. For I am from there, and I went to Bethlehem in Judah, but I am now going to my house. And no man will take me into his house.'" What an indictment. For him to say this as a guest in a city, for him to, you know, speak these words is quite an indictment. And he goes on and he wants to make it plain that, hey, the problem isn't, you know, that I'm going to be costing somebody a lot of money. I brought my own provisions. He says, "Yeah, there's both straw and fodder for our donkeys. There's also bread and wine for me, for your maidservant, for the young man who is with your servants. There's no lack of anything. In other words, I brought all these resources. That's not even an issue." So the old man, he considered it all and he said, "Peace to you. Only let me take care of all your needs." In other words, as a host, I don't want you to, you know, spend your provisions. It's the duty of the host to take care of you. I'll take that on myself. So let me take care of you. However, and here's the word of warning. The old man knew what was going on in the town. He said, "Do not spend the night in the open square. Don't be spending the night in the open square. No." So he took him into his house, and he gave the donkeys fodder, and they washed their feet, and they ate and drank. Oh, what a pleasant scene. What a nice place to visit, the city of Gibeah. Everything's going great. But this is a this second shockwave. This is a shocking lack of hospitality. mentality on the part of these men of Gibeah. It's just the basics of common courtesy, the basic things that everybody should know how to do correctly. They've just been thrown aside by people who are totally selfish and who are totally degraded in their passion. So we see in verses 10 to 21 here, first of all, we see an example of hospitality denied, and then we're going to see hospitality that gets offered to him. But the hospitality situation, it's just so shocking in contrast to what he had experienced in the home of his father-in-law there. And you think of the significance of hospitality. Again, I'm going to quote from Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 19. The instructions that were given in Leviticus 19, verse 33 to 34. When a stranger resides with you in your land, you shall do him no wrong. The stranger who resides with you shall be to you as the native among you. You shall love him as yourself, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Well, that was for strangers, and here you have a fellow Israelite. That's why he even chose to stay in Gibeah instead of the city of the Jebusites. He figured that I'll at least find greater safety in this city. I at least won't feel that I'm an imposition upon these people, because as a fellow countryman, they're obligated to show love and concern for me. We worship the same God. We have the same value system. This is not something where I'm asking them to do something that puts them out. Like I said, I even brought my own provisions with me. But here, regardless, we're all to view everything that we own not as owners, not as something we possess. It's a gift from God. All that we have in terms of our home, in terms of our food, our shelter, our clothing, all that we have is a gift from God, and we're stewards of it to share and to use for the glory of God and for the purpose of his kingdom. And so he doesn't have any expectation here that he's doing something that's going to make himself an imposition on these people. He has the right expectation that hospitality is what should be offered and provided. You think of Hebrews chapter 13, verse 2, the famous passage about entertaining angels. It says, Hebrews chapter 13, 2, he says, verses 1 and 2, let love of the brethren continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. For by this, some have entertained angels without knowing it. So we make that reference back to the days of Abraham there. And just talk about the importance of hospitality. Again, the book of Romans makes this plain as well in terms of, as Christians, the commitment that we must have towards hospitality. In chapter 12, Romans 12, verse 13, it says, you need to be contributing to the needs of the saints, you need to be practicing hospitality. So that's something that still carries over to our responsibilities today in terms of how we are able to entertain even strangers, not just people that we even know, but how we have that mindset that we're stewards and we're using things for God's glory. That's why one of the requirements for an elder, for a church officer, is that he be given to hospitality, that he be one that shows generosity and love and cares for others in this way. So we see the denial of hospitality, and then we see the hospitality offered by this old man who doesn't, he seemed the least likely the person to offer. In the first place, it seems odd to me that this old man still has to go out in the fields and still has to labor every day, and he's coming back at dark, coming through the gates of the city. He has no one to take care of his needs. As an older man, he's traveled to this place. He's sort of dislocated himself. He has that geographic bond with the Levite. They both came from that same remote hill country of Ephraim, and yet he, even though it says he's sort of a sojourner here, he's enough of a resident that he has a house. So he owns a house here, but he doesn't seem to have much of a household. His daughter, he has a virgin daughter, and this virgin daughter, by virtue of the fact that he's an older man, this virgin daughter probably is not a very young daughter either. So she has not been given in marriage, and here she's getting on maybe a little bit in age herself. But here's one that you would least expect of the ones that should have shown hospitality to him. That's why he located himself and his concubine and his servant and his donkeys. They took up, they domiciled themselves. They tried to set up their tent right in that open square. Right as you enter inside the gate of the city, they're in that open area there. So as people come through that gate, as they come back from their work, whatever it was they did during the day, they would have access to see. He'd be visible so that his need would be apparent. And so he felt that by making his need apparent in that way, that he would be responded to and he would be taken care of. But it's only this older gentleman that had this point of commonality from a geographical standpoint, and also he has this awareness of the danger that this Levite was putting himself in, which the Levite was completely unaware of what the situation was in the town there of Gibeah. But this gentleman, he knew what the situation was. He says, you can't spend the night in the open square. And so he took them in, and they're basically enjoying that hospitality now. They took care of the animals' needs. Now they've got a chance to feast a little bit. They have a chance to drink, to make merry. So they're in a good place for a few minutes here, and now everything is going to explode around them. So verses 22 to 26, the third shockwave here, this shocking, lustful sexual attack, the callousness that's reflected in this account, where the conscience is no longer even engaged as to what is right and wrong. It's just sort of almost acting like animals in terms of self-preservation, the instincts of self-preservation, and just doing things that are so counterintuitive to how we think people with any type of a conscience should reason and should make decisions. And yet, it's just complete callousness and depraved conditions here. So this is getting into the sick part of this chapter here, verses 22 to 26. While they were celebrating, so in this old man's house, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, these are called sons of Belial. They're just base people. They're people that are worthless. They surrounded the house. Wow, that's pretty intimidating. It's not just a couple people knocking on your front door. This is a mob mentality that's surrounding the house, pounding the door, not knocking politely. They spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came into your house, that we may have sexual relations with him." Then the man, the owner of the house, he went after them. He said to them, "No, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly." He's not surprised by their request. He knows the kind of people that live in the city. He knows what their appetites are sexually. He knows what their intentions are. And he now is scared to death. He says, "No, this man has come into my house. I've taken the responsibility of offering refuge and protection and hosting this man. Do not commit this act of folly." But now, here's where it goes so bad. He says, "Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out that you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish. But do not commit such an act of folly, of homosexual rape against this man." But the men would not listen to him. So their intensity is just stepping up and everything is just totally out of control. So the man, and it's left vague here, I think it's talking about in the Hebrew as to which man, whether it's the homeowner or whether it's the Levite. So the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them. And they raped her and abused her all night until morning, then let her go at the approach of dawn. As the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was until full daylight. This is just a brazen demand that is made here, and it reminds you of the depravity of Sodom and Gomorrah. Turn back to Genesis chapter 19, because there's definitely the parallels between these stories, and even between the language that's used is just so plain that they want us to remember back from the Genesis 19 story in verses 4 to 8. Back in the story of Lot, we'll start in verse 1 of chapter 19. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. So these are two angels, and he doesn't know that they're angels. That's what Hebrews 13 was making reference to. And when Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed down with his face to the ground. He said, "Now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house. Spend the night, wash your feet, then you may rise early and go on your way." They said, however, "No, we shall spend the night in the square." Uh-oh, dangerous to spend. Don't spend nights in the square. Yet he urged them strongly, so they turned aside to him. They entered his house. So it's the same situation. He prepared a feast for them, baked unleavened bread. They ate before they lay down. The men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. They called aloud. They said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? bring them out to us so we may have relations with them. But Lot went out to them at the doorway. He shut the door behind him. He said, please, my brothers. Isn't it? It's just so sad to call such ones brothers. And yet that's what the man is doing back in the city of Gibeah. He's referring to them as my fellows, my brothers. What a sad case to be identified with those people. Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them. But Lot went out to them at the doorway. He shut the door behind him. He said, please, my brothers, don't act wickedly. Exactly what we have. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with men. Please let me bring them out to you. Do to them whatever you like. Only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof. And they pressed him, and they pressed him. And we see that the, apart from the angels intervening, we would have had the same situation. We don't have the angels intervening now in this situation here, but the parallels are, again, just so strong and so blatant. Proverbs chapter 29, verse 18, where there is no vision, where there is no clear revelation from God as to what the will and the pathway of God is, where the people don't understand the vision, the message from God, it says the people are unrestrained. They run wild into all types of depraved behavior. But happy is he who keeps the law. That's Proverbs 29, verse 18. And that's what we see here is what happens when there is no legal structure to restrain men's depravity. And they're allowed to just act on what their sinful desires and the lusts of the flesh are. And we see that worked out in such an extreme circumstance here because it's meant to shock us that apart from the grace of God, here's where we end up because of our sinful condition. This is what we look like to God is the depths of this type of sin. And so it's a barbaric act of cowardice and self-preservation for them to thrust this concubine out. I mean, it's on the one hand, it's somewhat courageous of the owner of the house to say, I'm not just going to give up this Levite. I'm not just going to throw him out there to you. But it's so cowardly for the men not to stand up for the females in this context and not to take the leadership to say, we're the ones that are supposed to be protecting the women. We're the ones that are supposed to stand. If that means we give up our life, we give up our life. But you don't see that. You see this self-preservation and this cowardly type of behavior. And so there's this brutal attack. I mean, this woman is treated like property both by the Levite who gives her up as well as by these men who then rape her and take advantage of her. And it's just such a sad occurrence. I mean, it's interesting that there's no names given in this account. As you read through this account, the people involved, even though it's such a long extended story, the people basically remain nameless. And some of the commentators have speculated, well, why is it? You know, what is the motif that the narrator is using here as to why these people should remain anonymous? And they give two basic considerations. One is, it points to the universal nature of this conduct. I mean, this concubine could represent any woman in terms of how someone was abused and treated and disregarded, and there wasn't any concept of sanctity of life. There wasn't any concept of the value of the individual. There wasn't any concept of the place of women in an exalted sense. I mean, everything is just degraded to the nth degree, and so by remaining nameless, it just has that sense of universality that it applies to everyone, and it's so prevalent throughout the nation. And then it also has a dehumanizing type of effect where it just shows how worldly the culture is and how they assimilated pagan and barbaric values to the extent that there is no respect for people. And everything is dehumanized in that sense. And so we finish up the account in verse 27 to 30. We're going to see this shocking lesson. It's sort of a letter that's sent, but it's a letter of dismemberment. That's an object lesson, as it were. And we see how communication, it just, in its graphic form, communication just keeps intensifying, because to get anybody's attention, it seems like you got to go to the nth degree, and then you got to go higher. That's how we are in our media-driven culture. I mean, communication and the graphical content of things, it just is worse and worse. And again, there's nothing. How do you even get shocked anymore? I mean, it's just out there. The imagery is so blatant and it's so vile. And that's what you have here as the reaction of this Levite is recorded in verses 27 to 30. It's not recorded as a model of this is how God wants us to respond. Yes, God wants us to respond in moral outrage. Yes, God wants us to take a stand against evil and against depravity. God doesn't want us cutting up corpses and sending around corpses in the manner that we're going to see reflected here. So again, we're going to be shocked by the actions that take place here in verse 27 to 30. When her master arose in the morning, this is that tender, sensitive guy here. When he arose in the morning, he opened the doors of the house, he went out to go on his way. Then behold, his concubine was lying at the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up and let us go." There was no answer. Then he placed her on the donkey. It's like he threw her on the donkey like a sack of trash or something. The man arose and he went to his home. When he entered his house, he took a knife. And he laid hold of his concubine and he cut her in 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel. So I don't know, maybe the tribe of Benjamin got their message as well. All who saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or even been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider it. Take counsel and speak up." This depravity, as much as this Levite would like to ignore it, would like to turn the other way and sort of put his face in the sand and act like nothing had happened, here reality just stares him right in the face. He walks out the door. It's like he's going to, first of all, how could he even have slept the night before? I mean, it's like he throws this woman out there and then he just, I don't know if they continued on eating and drinking, but he seems like he had a good night's sleep. You know, I'm concerned, is he checking for the welfare? He's forgot about this concubine. He's written her off, and that's a chapter that he wants to be done with and over with, is how callous this man is. And now he walks out, and God makes it plain, you're not going to get away from this. You're going to be able to walk away and not be faced with the reality of what's happened. And so the woman is right there, lying at the threshold, been able to crawl back to that point, but then expired right there at the threshold. And so he can't just avoid it, and yet his attitude is one of disdain and disinterest and lack of sensitivity. I mean, the tone, you know, I'm conjecturing as to how he says these words, but to say, "Get up and let's go home," I mean, you just can't imagine the condition that she's in, and that's going to be the expression he's using, this commanding. It's almost like he's disgusted with her for what's transpired, even though he's the one that's at fault in the deal. And so you just have, I mean, you certainly have no respect left at all for the Levite when you get to this point in the narrative. And so he has a complete lack of sensitivity. That's why when it says he spoke tenderly to her before, I mean, the contrast between going to retrieve her at her father's house and speaking tenderly to her, and then how he really ends up treating her. And then he goes and he goes through this exercise of dismemberment, which is meant to shock us. I mean, we're not to think that that is just okay. We're not to think that there's not to be respect shown to the body of the dead throughout the Old Testament as they bury people. Look at the respect that's always accorded to people, and how important it is that you be buried in a fitting and a respectful fashion. I don't know. There might even be implications for cremation and all when you look at some of these passages in the Old Testament. Now, I'm certainly not one to favor something that would show any lack of disrespect. You know, I know people say, well, the body's going to decay anyway. It's empty. There's no spirit in it. So what? It's just a body. But that doesn't mean that we should hasten the decay process, or that we should assist in, or that we should disregard the significance of a body that's going. When we believe in the resurrection, we believe, you know, that there's going to be long-term significance for a body being reunited, a resurrected body, as Jesus Christ leads us in that resurrection. But here, the disregard for this dead body and how she's treated. But again, it's almost as if God is saying, in order to shock people, in order to get anybody's attention, things are so bad that it's come to this in order to be able to get somebody's attention. And so it's a very sad thing. Again, something that looks like it's just this private crisis in this one household is now going to escalate to have national ramifications, and especially at the tribal level, this tribe of Benjamin is almost going to be wiped out. So hopefully today we go through these object lessons here. Hopefully we're shocked by the depths of depravity that can be exhibited in a society that has lost its moral compass. And we need to go back and we need to be shocked at our own society. And we need to be shocked at the level to which we have sunk in our own society. Proverbs chapter 4, chapter 14, verse 34. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a disgrace to any people. Righteousness exalts a nation. We are not an exalted nation. We might try to act like an exalted nation. We might try to distinguish ourselves from the other nations of the world and get on our high horse and say how better we are. You know, we're better than this and that. But we are not an exalted nation. Righteousness is what exalts a nation. Sin is a disgrace to any people. Compromise always paves the way for moral decline. And we see common courtesy in terms of hospitality. We see the biblical mandates of how we need to treat others. Those mandates need to be restored in terms of how we show love and consideration and meet the needs of other people. Instead, we become calloused like they became calloused here. And so this graphic nature of communication just seems to intensify in our media-driven culture. And we are just so much like what is reflected here. So we ask, well, how does God want us to live? In the midst of this type of situation, God doesn't want us to be absorbed, to be assimilated into our culture to the extent that this Levite had been absorbed into the pagan culture around him. God does not want us to live in that manner. It says in Philippians chapter 2, verse 15, we're called to live as children of God, above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. We know that we live in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, but we're called to be children of God. That's something special and distinctive and a privileged calling that we need to exhibit. And we're to appear as lights in the world. The world is totally dark. And we're to appear as lights, holding fast the word of life because we have the message of the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ, who can bring light and life, who is the way and the truth and the life, and can reestablish that relationship with the holy God that we sang about this morning. We cannot afford to choose to just do whatever's right in our own eyes. We can't choose to be our own traffic controller. We've got to respond to the direction that we get from the Lord in His Scriptures. He is the one that has the best perspective, how to guide our lives, how to save us from the type of moral catastrophe that we see in this chapter here. Let's pray.